Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is a show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. This book that I'm reviewing today is called Two Like the Lightning by Ada Palmer. And it's the first book in the Terra Ignota series, although judging by what happened in this book, it's probably not so much of a series, it's just two parts of one story. And I kind of knew that, not going in, but at the start of this book, I saw it was Terra Ignota number one, so I thought, okay, there's more coming up later. But then there's always that thing that you go, ah, okay, you get to the end of a book, and it's not really first book in a series. It's not the first story in a series of stories. It's really just one story broken up into pieces. Thankfully, I kind of worked that out not quite near the beginning. Right at the beginning of the book, he says, okay, this is 7 days. I'm going to tell you a story of what happened over 7 days. And then about halfway through the book, he's like, okay, and now that's the end of day two. And I'm like, okay, this is definitely not the full 7 days, and then we'll get another 7 days later on. And then at the end of the book, he says, yes, this is actually going to continue on with another book, but let's just wrap up what happened at the end of day three, and kind of goes into a bit of that there. So, if I get to the end of a book and it's something like, boom, actually, this is not the end of the story, you've got to like wait a year before the next book comes out, that would have been quite upsetting to me. But I kind of worked out going in. It reminds me a bit of, what's the Name of the Wind books there? They're like, okay, let me tell you a story. It's going to take me 3 days to tell you this story. Or we've got 3 days to tell you this story. And I'm like, oh, this audiobook's like 48 hours long. That's about 3 days worth of storytelling. Then at the end of 48 hours, he's like, okay, that's the end of day one of storytelling. You're like, how did you tell 48 hours worth of audiobook stories in an 8-hour storytelling session? So not as bad as that. But what we got to go through here now. Okay, so Two Like the Lightning, Terra Ignota number one. So this is a very, very interesting book for me. The reason I read it was because I was doing this thing. I worked out that, hey, I read most of the books on the Nebula Awards and Hugo Award lists for the last year, for 2016. And because there was quite a bit of an overlap and I'd read a few of them. And so I thought, well, let's just check out some of the others that I haven't read yet. So I read a few different bits and pieces. Some of them I quite enjoyed. Others I didn't enjoy very much, so much that I just stopped reading it. Everfair, I think, that was one of them. I just stopped after a few chapters because I was like, yep, this is really not my kind of thing. And one of them, which was by, what was it? It was like a third book in the series, which began with the three-body problem. And I enjoyed some of the ideas in that book, but it's some of the worst writing that I've ever read. So I didn't check that one out. But yes, Two Like the Lightning was the last book in that group of 7 or 8 books which I hadn't checked out. So I thought, hey, let's just get the audiobook and go into it. And I heard a little bit of people saying, oh, this is a bit of a slog to get through and it's trying to be too clever. But I absolutely love this book. There was so much stuff going on in this book which hit exactly the sweet spot for me, that I was just like, okay, this is actually, at the start it was a little bit weird because it starts off and the narrator is talking to the audience, to his reader, very, very, you know, directly. It's like direct address in one direction and back in the other directions. He's going, okay, dear reader, I'm going to say this and I'm going to do this, and this is the way that I'm going to tell this story. Are you ready for me to tell this story? Okay, sit there, let's go for it. But also, throughout the book, he imagines what the audience is thinking or what the reader is thinking and kind of heckling himself back again and saying, Mycroft, you can't do this. Mycroft, what you need to do is this. Or how can you stop at this part of the story and go off in this tangent? Hey, Mycroft, get back onto the story. So he's all the time imagining what the reader would be thinking at that point, commenting back at him, imagining what the reader would say back, and then replying to that and having conversations between his imagined reader and himself as the narrator as it goes through. And sometimes it caught me by surprise because I wasn't really thinking that, and he was just like, hey, narrator, what are you thinking? Why are you angry at me? Why are you saying, you know, you're now angry at me for using this kind of language? Are you angry at me for not getting on with the story over here? And I was like, no, I wasn't angry. I was actually enjoying that. But other times he would be like, yes, dear reader, I know what you're thinking right now. You're thinking this, this, and this. And I was like, yes, I was thinking that. And I was kind of thinking, was this story written first and then sort of like put aside for a while? And then the original author went back through and read through and was like, oh, at this point, it would be funny if the reader would comment, or Mycroft would think that the reader is going to comment this way. Or maybe, maybe she actually thought, this bit's going on a bit too long. And instead of just editing it down shorter, she actually just puts a comment in saying, hey, this bit of the story is going a bit too long. So just in the terms of storytelling, I really liked this, you know, being directly addressed by the author, and the reply is going back through, which is cool, because this book is trying to... It's sort of like a science fiction book set, you know, 400 years in the future, but with the idea of... you know, looking it through the philosophy and culture, and there's kind of like a fetishization of enlightenment philosophy and fashions and styles in, you know, 400, 500 years in our future. So it's lots of stuff going back to the 1800s, not the 1800s, the 18th century, 1700s, and there's lots of talk about Voltaire and Marquis de Sade and all of these different characters and the way that they would use language, or, you know, authors would use language then, saying, okay, dear reader, we are going to do this, is brought out really well in this weird science fictional world set, like I say, 500 years... Oh, what is it saying? Goodreads here says, it's the custom of the 25th century. So, yeah, 25th century. So, 400 years in the future, roughly. So, the setting of this book... is this interesting setting, because it starts off when you're like, oh, you're introduced to a family or a basht, I think it's called, which is a unit of kind of like a family unit, but you can be adopted into it, or they get together. Sometimes they're hereditary, but sometimes it'll just be like a group of friends say, hey, let's set up a unit, let's set up a family, a home unit. But it isn't just mother, father, and then kids. It's like a whole group of people living together, and if they have kids, whatever, like that. So, you know, these like mini communes. And the world that this, the place that this is set up is kind of like a post-scarcity society. And one thing I enjoyed was saying that, okay, we don't actually need to work for a living. Like, all our needs are taken care of. Everything's taken care of. But work still needs to be done. So some people have to work like 5 hours a week, and some people work 3 hours a week, and some people work 10 hours a week. So work still has to be done by humans, but, you know, there's way too many humans for the work that actually needs to be done. So so some of the people become vocateurs. And there's this passage at the start where they said, okay, instead of someone choosing their vocation, or their vocation choosing them, they choose their vocation. So they say, hey, I'm actually going to be a kind of priest, or I'm going to be a policeman, or I'm going to be a tax accountant. And they just go, yeah, this is actually what I love doing, so I'm now going to work. I'm not getting paid for it. I don't need to be doing this. If I didn't do this work, other people would be able to pick up the slack, but I want to put in 50 hours a week into this job because I really enjoy being a teacher, or I really enjoy being whatever, you know. And the idea being that this post-scarcity society is all running smoothly, and war has been abolished. Nobody is allowed to practice organized religion anymore, and or have, you know, these different different views, which may or may not cause war. It seems like all ills of the past seem to be stuck onto organized religion, and said, okay, if we're going to ban that, that's fine. And now there's not going to be any wars anymore, and there has been peace for, you know, 200 years in this book. But as we go through the book, we realize that this post-scarcity, almost a utopia, like, oh, everyone's happy, everything's going fine, everyone's great, you know, everything on the surface is fantastic. This, as we go through this pretty chunky book, it's like a 20-hour... Let's just go quickly have a look at the audiobook and see how long this audiobook is. So, yeah, it was like two quite chunky bits. Oh, it just says finished. Oh, I don't like that about... Audible, sometimes it'll just say, okay, the book is finished, so now we will no longer tell you how long you have just read. You know, we don't tell you how long you've got to read. We're just going to say what's finished. No, I can't even see how long it is on Audible. I should have checked that. Anyway, big chunky audiobook. As you go through the audiobook, you really do discover that that things aren't as smooth as you would think, and all the politics isn't as smooth as you think, and all the other things not quite as smooth and as enlightened as the Enlightenment stuff. I mean, it is enlightened, but, like, you know, some of the dirty underbelly of this society starts coming up to the fore, and you realise, maybe it's not as perfect as we think. Again, I don't want to get too much into that, because that is moving into spoiler territory. Let's just look at the blurb at the start of this on Goodreads. Mycroft Canner is a convict. For his crimes, he is required, as is the custom of the 25th century, to wander the world being as useful as he can to all he meets. Carlyle Foster is a senseiya, a spiritual counsellor in a world that has outlawed the public practice of religion, but which also knows that the inner lives of humans cannot be washed away. So our main character, our narrator character, is Mycroft Canner, this convict. And all the time he's saying, oh, yes, I'm a convict. Now I'm just a servitor. I can't remember the exact terminology. But, yeah, anyone who's been convicted of a crime, like murder or anything like that, is put to work. They just have to travel around the world. Oh, and by the way, everyone can travel around. There's nowhere in the world is more than like an hour's journey away. So some of the action takes place in the UK, and some of it Paris, and some of it Tokyo, and that people can just turn up whenever they want, or wherever they want quite easily. And that's quite an important part later on. Oh, yeah, that becomes more and more important as we go through the book. So he is someone who can just travel around, and he's like required to go places and work. And even though he is a criminal, and we're not told at the start of the book what he did wrong, as it comes up later on, it starts going, oh, you're like, oh, okay. And it gets like what he might have done. It starts off, oh, maybe he killed someone by accident. And then it's like, oh, no, maybe he killed more than one. And as once it actually revealed what his crime is and why he is now a convict, why he is fulfilling this role in society that he does, I really enjoyed that revelation and what it actually still means to him as our narrator. Of course, because we've got the direct address, he can be thinking, you must have been wondering what my crime is, but he never brings it up. He just, you know, says what he is in the world and then bring things up as not as they are needed. You know, there's that unreliable. It's like, well, he's not. Is he lying to us? Maybe he is lying to us. Whatever's going on. So he is was originally kind of like in this very close to power family, because the power stays within these bars. It stays kind of in these hereditary family units, and as the book goes on, you see how more and more kind of incestuous it is, in the way that, oh, this person is the son of this person, now they're in charge of this, and there's lots of different connections. It's like, yeah, well, that's the way the world works. It's all about who you know or who you're related to or who is being adopted into the family. It's kind of Roman in that way, where they're like, okay, well, this emperor, he adopted the son, you know, he adopted this person as his son, and then he became the next emperor. You don't give the power over to your biological son, because, you know, biological son, probably not worthy to be an emperor, but yeah, adopt someone to be your son and they can become an emperor. See the beginning of the movie Gladiator for how that can go wrong and right. So this is one of those setups, and Mycroft Canner was obviously, you can kind of see straight away that he's got lots of connections to powerful people, so he was once part of one of these bars, and that's revealed later that yes, he was. And so he is kind of like he's not just a normal person, like, oh, we need some, you know, some stuff moving or this place clearing. You, convict, come and clear up here. He is sort of like, hey, we need this numerical analysis and statistical analysis going on over here. We need you now. And then the emperor says, oh, okay, we're going to call you in. So that's our main character, and he is he's like a close friend to a Barsh, which is actually in control of the car system, the transport system. Like I say, everyone can get everywhere in the world in just a few minutes or an hour or so, and to do that, you get into these cars which fly, these supersonic cars which fly around and drop people off and pick people up wherever they need to go. And one family is kind of controlling the software and controlling the systems to do all of that. It kind of belongs to them, and there's a lot of power in that family. And even though there's just a few people there, they kind of attract more and more attention and more power than is probably warranted for just a single group of like 10 people or so. So all of the book really the book kicks off with this family, this Barsht, being like framed for a crime which they obviously didn't commit, but there's someone's trying to throw a spanner into the works and trying to work out what's going on, you know. So this policeman detective turns up, and his name was Martin, I think. Let me flick over to my notes. Yeah, Martin, the policeman, and he goes over and sees this Barsht and is like, right, what's going on here? And then the rest of the book, which is most of the book, is sort of like in the background. This Martin is kind of investigating this, and other people are trying to sort of like stop the investigation going forward or work out the political ramifications of the story going forward. Of this, investigation going forward, and there's other people come in, and there's bad people coming in, and good people coming in, and all trying to work out what is going on. And by the end of this book, it is kind of revealed what might be going on, but we still don't know who is behind it or who has knowledge of this, the overall plot, and who did that, and what there's trying to be revealed, and what's trying to be covered up. And there's loads of different factions in this book. There's the idea being that in the future, there's no single country. Countries. You don't have a nationality, or you can have a nationality, but also you'll be part of these tribes. I can't remember the exact name of them, but there's like the Masons, which are kind of like the Roman kind of people, and the Humanists, and the Mitsubishis, and the Europeans, and the Cousins, and the Utopians, and some others. Like, there's seven main tribes, and there's some smaller ones as well, but these are kind of your nations. You kind of work for them, pay taxes to them, live within them, and they look after you. And there's other people who are kind of like lawless, who are outside of all this system, and they can just be if they meet each other and there's two lawless people, they can just kill each other or do anything to each other, but they have to just, you know, rely on the other person being trustworthy, and maybe they're not trustworthy, but are they trustworthy? All that kind of stuff. So, yeah, there's these different factions, and there's a lot of politics. This is mostly a book about, you know, hidden agendas and politics, and someone who is close to the center of power seeing all the political machinations going on around it, and I really enjoyed all of that kind of stuff. Anyway, I've talked so much about actually what the setup and the world of this book is, not even talking very much about the characters, because there's just so much going on in this book. Like I say, it's a really chunky book, and even as we're getting on, like, we're getting all the way through it, normally by about halfway through a book, you're like, right, I've kind of got a handle on how the world works. Now let's get moved forward with the plot. But because the plotting is so slow, well, not even so slow, but it's so measured. Like, there's long conversations, and it'd be like, okay, I've just been listening in on a 30-minute conversation about this ethical dilemma, or a 30-minute conversation about, or 20 minutes about this specific subject and why people live this way. And because Mycroft, our narrator, is always talking, sometimes he'll say, okay, I was here, and so I can remember this, how this conversation went, and here it was. Or I recorded this one, and now this is more of a transcript of how this conversation went, this way, then that way. And other times it's like, well, I wasn't here, but this person was here, and they told me. And sometimes it's like, well, I wasn't there, but this person was, so now I'm going to let them tell this next part of the story, and then, you know, the other person will say some stuff. It's like, oh, now I wasn't there, so I'm going to use my imagination for a lot of this. But, you know, I know this person very well, so I can kind of guess how they replied to a lot of these things. So, here's this part of the story. And like you say, even as you get through to this, it's sort of like, and now that's the end of day 3 of 7. And I've just been listening to this audiobook for like almost 20 hours, and we're only 3 days into it. It's because a lot of these conversations and a lot of what happens is pretty much told in real time, which means it's super dense. The story is moving in some ways really slowly, but as more and more of the world is being revealed, I get very much, you know, there's very much of a feel of like, wow, how many more layers of complexity and world building can go on here. And it is, like I say, it's super dense and super interesting, so many levels. Another thing which makes it interesting is that two characters will have the same name, and you're like, well, why did that character change their name? And then you go, oh, okay, now I understand why that character changed their name away from that. So there are two Mycrofts in the book. It's like, oh, this person's actually called Mycroft as well, but they changed their name because of reasons, and now they're called something else. But then there's quite a few characters who have more than one name. So they'll be introduced to this thing, and then they'll say, oh, this one, oh, that's actually what the Mitsubishi faction tribe calls that person because they have their own name. Oh, and actually he's got another name over here, and he's got this other name over there. And there's even conversations in the book of sort of like, oh, what name are we going to call them? And also all the different tribes, there's the universal language, which is English, but then the Masons always speak Latin to each other, and the Europeans always speak French, and the Mitsubishi always speak Japanese, even though the majority of them are Chinese and some Indians in there as well, and all these different things. So every person has got like a way they are called in their own language, like a nickname for them. In all of this, one of the main themes is this idea that you can't have organized public expressions of religion, but people still have spiritual needs. So there's a kind of a sensei job, a role. It's like a priest slash a therapist, which is like you talk to someone and they'll say, okay, what do you think about this? Do you believe in a single god, or do you believe in many gods, or what kind of god? And they'll kind of construct out of questions and answers with their client what kind of spiritual needs they have. And because they've learned about like every single religion of the past, they can, you know, cherry pick from different places a set of kind of like philosophical, spiritual ideals that somebody, and to help somebody live by. But it's no two people are practicing the same religion, and you don't practice it publicly. It's all a private thing that you do in your own mind and in your own home. And with the idea being that by removing all of this, removing this stuff from public display, and there won't be any majority of anything. There's always a thing, no, we don't want anybody to be a majority, because as soon as you've got a majority of something or some people or someone, that's when trouble can come. But because we're all minorities, and they kind of take this idea of minorities and remove it all the way down, so everybody is like a minority of one. And what was I going to say about this? Oh, yeah. So the whole idea being that there is no religion. However, this entire story kicks off with us being introduced to somebody called Bridger. And this is right in the very start. So you don't need to. This is like chapter one. Bridger is this young kid who's like 13 years old who can do miracles. He can bring toys alive. He can anything that is like an abstract or like a representation of something, a non-abstract representation of something. So draw a picture of something, make a model of something. He can touch it and think about it and bring it to life. So if he wants some food, he just draws some food or cuts out some pieces of paper in the shape of some food and brings them to life. He's got all these toy soldiers and he just touches them and they come alive. With the idea being that this story is about a world in which religion has been removed from everything, but now a miracle worker has suddenly arrived in it. However, it's never entirely clear if this is really part of the story or if this is sort of Mycroft, as our main character, is this an unreliable narrator? He even says, look, you don't have to believe in Bridger and his capabilities, but that is what this story is about. Bridger is the protagonist in this story, so even though he doesn't actually do very much in this story, it's sort of like, yeah, he is the most important person in the world. There is nobody else more important than this, because he can, you know, you make a model of something, or paint a picture of someone, or have something like that, and he can bring it to life in a way which brings them back to life. So if it's a dead person, there's a model of a dead person, a statue of a dead person, touch that person, and going to bring that person back to life again. And they will actually have the memories, kind of like the memories of them when they were a real person alive, but also like their like expected and believed memories from what Bridger believes about that person too. So it's a very powerful thing. And the idea being, okay, we're in a science fiction world, which is all about the Enlightenment and all about rejecting religion and rejecting this and rejecting this, but do miracles exist? Which is a pretty interesting turn for the book to take. Well, not, it doesn't take that turn. It starts off with that turn. And as you go through, you're like, okay, this is going to be, this is really weird. And this book, like I say, is just crazy from beginning to end. So much rubbish. So much stuff is thrown in there. Just sort of like, okay, let's just throw everything in the world. But you know what? For me, it worked. I understand how people might think this book a bit of a slog. But it worked for me. Like, there's nothing in this book which I didn't really, really enjoy. Like, even the pacing of it, that it is set so slow and that so much is happening, but that allows, like, okay, there's very few other books where you're just like, okay, let's just take 20 minutes and talk about, you know, this thing, or like the, there's this whole section where Bridger is sort of like, okay, there's this toy made it into a small soldier, and now that small soldier has died, someone trod on it or whatever happened, now shall I bring it back to life or not? And there's this whole 20 minute discussion of like, okay, it's a toy that you brought to life and so now exists as a person with memories, even though the person is only like 1 inch high, this little toy soldier figure. And but now what do you do? Should you bring it back to life if you have the power to bring something back to life? And there's this long exploration of the morals and ethics and what should be the right or wrong thing to do. And I don't know, it's not the kind of thing that you normally get in science fiction, because it is very much like taking on the style of a Voltaire saying, okay, let's explore this kind of thing, and with the clever language going backwards and forwards, sort of like, and what should we do about this? And how, what about this? You know, sort of like a whole treatise on this. And this book contains quite a few of those like morality treatises within the book as well, because that's what Mycroft, our narrator, is doing. You know, that's, you know, he's even says, okay, this is the kind of thing that they did back in the day, that Voltaire did and Marcus de Sade did and these other philosophers back in the 18th century did. And he even talks about that like explicitly, but also within the book, that is what this book is doing. And I really enjoyed that setup. Well, what other notes do I have here? I mean, I could talk more about the world building and the characters and stuff, but it's like this, like I say, there's just so much going on here. It's sort of like, well, how do I even pick out one or two characters to talk about? Because they are all so well realized, but also so well realized through the eyes of probably an unreliable narrator. Suddenly someone will be introduced and they'll say, ah, this person is actually one of the most important people in the story, but it's actually 3/4 of the way through this book so far, but I have kept them from you because I wanted you to see what this story was like all the way through, you know, up until this point. So that's an interesting thing. What else have I do? Oh, yeah. So there's this thing that happens in the book, in this book, because it's set so far in the future. Gender identity is not a specific... it's like there's lots of they versus he and she and they. And I've come to the conclusion that I really love this in books, that if you talk about, and I mentioned this in the last podcast, but it's happened so many times recently in these books where they're talking about the characters and the gender is just something to be described later on. So many people are just they, and even Mycroft, the narrator, is saying, okay, I'm going to use he for this person, even though he has breasts and doesn't have a penis, I'm going to use he because he acts in a more, you know, manly way. And for this person, oh, this person, yes, she had a penis, but it's definitely a she because the way that she protected her family was with the fierceness of a mother. So definitely a she for this one. And he's even saying, Mycroft, like the narrator suddenly goes, Mycroft, why are you saying this? I don't think you should do this. And then he's replying to himself, well, I have to do this because, you know, it's probably best I took this. So there's even a discussion going on with the narrator, with his imaginary reader, about the different gender things. And there's actually a point where they go into... where's the notes? It must be on my phone, this note. Oh, yeah, here it is. So they'll go to this orgy and saying... it says, oh, yes, and there were men and women of both sexes. And I was like, men and women of both sexes? Oh, I see. Because they're all dressed up in period garb, and some men are wearing women's outfits and some women are wearing men's outfits. And so they're all there, and the people in men's outfits, historical men's outfits, it doesn't matter if they are female underneath or male underneath. And there's this whole game within this... this brothel where the men will come along and try to seduce the women, and the women have to put off the men's advances and all that kind of stuff. It's sort of like a game that is played. You're never quite sure how serious it is at that point, but you know, there is this, there's these roles being played, and someone says, oh, I would never be able to do this because I'm not into men, he says. But here we have gentlemen of both genders. And I really enjoy that. Gentlemen, men and women of both sexes, and we have gentlemen of both genders. And there's another quote that I made here. There's so much great writing in this. It says, sex is in everything, and if you deny it, you are heading into battle with one less weapon. And if you don't believe that, you should get laid. There's so much of the good writing here. There's another quote that I made. No matter how many thousand years into the future, drunk people will never become less stupid. And I only made a note of a few of those quotes, but the writing in this book. But bringing back to the with the gendered pronouns and they versus he and she, I must admit, I really enjoy the idea of not knowing the gender, the biological gender of a character until it's either relevant to the plot or whatever. It's just going to be like another fact that comes along with it and doesn't have to influence like the power in the room or what my thoughts are as a, you know, as a 21st century reader about what, you know, me projecting onto the future what's going to happen. However, by using the pronoun they instead of he or she, we have the gender ambiguity, which I like, but it also introduces the, is this a singular or plural ambiguity? Because they can be talking about sort of like a family and a person in that family, and then they'll say, they don't want to do this, or they went there, or they are going in this direction. And even within this book, sometimes the they is talking about like the Barsh, the family unit, or the nationality. They don't want to do this. Who is they? Oh, they is all French people. But sometimes you go, oh, they don't want to do that. Well, who is the they? Well, it's this one monarch, or it's this one person who we're not going to refer to the gender of. And I must admit, I don't like the introduction of singular plural ambiguity into the gender ambiguity. So while I think they is great for people who want to be called they, or characters who need to be called they, or authors who want to use they, I think I would much prefer a non gender specific pronoun which wasn't a singular pronoun which isn't they. And like I say, there's different authors have used different pronouns, and to be honest, those pronouns do bring attention to themselves. If you just use they, it's like, well, that's a normal English word which we're all used to reading, and I'll just go with it. But it does introduce that other ambiguity along with the gender ambiguity, and I'd prefer a non singular plural ambiguous word to pronoun. Anyway, it's not a conversation that I can settle or even take sides on too much, but like I say, ambiguity, not in two ways, please, only ambiguity one way at a time. What else do I have to say about this book? I've talked about quite a lot about this book, but there's just so much stuff going on here. What else have we got? Some other characters? No, I don't need to go into characters. So what I want to say is that this book for me could be a five-star book, but it can't be a five-star book because it's only the first book. It's not like the first book in a series. For example, I gave Nine Fox Gambit a five-star review, a five-star rating. But that is it is kind of like a completed story. It has a beginning, middle, and end. And this book certainly has a beginning and half of a middle. It's not a unit of entertainment, so it can't satisfy me completely on my five stars rating, which in 10 years I think I've given like 10 books 5 stars. But I'm going to give it 4.5 stars. And if the second book is good and lives up to this, I think together they might get 5 stars, or it's possible that this could be a 5-star book for me. And I didn't expect this at all, because like I say, I hadn't heard that many good things about this book. So thankfully for me, I don't have to wait around, because the next book in this series, or the second half of this book, is out already. Because this is a book that was nominated for awards because it came out last year, it's like a year later, and the other book came out in July. However, I'm not going to tell you the name of that book until I say this. The blurb, the first sentence of the blurb on Goodreads and on Audible, and the back of the book blurb for the second book in the series, it's a massive, massive spoiler for one of the main questions and the main mysteries, which is only revealed in the last chapter of this second, of this first book, sorry. So don't go and look up the second book in this series and the blurb about it until you're ready to read it, because just looking through that first sentence spoils, well, it doesn't spoil, but it's sort of like, it just gives away, like, a massive reveal, like, half, like right at the end of this book, sort of like the main setup to that second book is like, oh, that's been happening all along, oh, I can't believe it, wow, that's amazing, how did you uncover what, like, and it's sort of like, it's setting up to that, and the blurb gives it away, so just don't read it. I don't know how they do this, sort of like, the second book should be, the first book was amazing, read this second book, or if you like the first book, this is the second book. Don't give away massive plot points in the first book in the first sentence of the blurb in the second book, because I'm really glad that I didn't do that, because if I'd have done it, I'd be like, hey, like, you get halfway through this book and you're like, should I, is there another book in this series, let me look it up, and you go and sort of like, oh, is this it, let me just read to make, like, more than just the title to make sure that this is the right, yeah, and already you're just like, oh, so halfway through this book that I'm reading now, by reading the blurb of the next book, it spoils this one. It's not even close. Anyway, the next book is out already, and I have already purchased it on Audible. I haven't downloaded it yet, because I've not been on Wi-Fi, and these books are quite chunky, and I'm not just going to use up my data plan, my roaming data, as I'm here in Greece at the moment, to check that out. So, let's go, though, to goodreads.com. The best way for me to see if other people are enjoying books that I'm reading, SFBRP listeners, is to check this out. Check out on goodreads.com if you become my friend. For example, Stevie Kincaid rated this book 5 stars. He's read it 2 times. He shelves it with best of 2016. So yeah, I think this is probably one of the best of 2016. For me, anyway. Although, again, it's difficult to say because it's only the first half of the book. I loved every minute of rereading this book. It was completely different reading Ada Palmer's prose from my initial experience listening to a brilliantly performed audiobook, which I want to get onto in a minute. So, he's even listed some of the things. Actually, that was the list that I copied from before, maybe. So Lindsay rated it 3 stars. Guillermo, I really wanted to like this. I was promised a blend of Enlightenment period philosophy and far future science fiction. I certainly got that. But he obviously didn't like other parts of it. Yeah, lots of 5- and 3-star reviews. Yeah, in total, this has got a 3.88 rating on Goodreads, which means a lot of people probably really like it, and a lot of people are giving it 2- and 3-star reviews, mainly because probably it's just a bit too much. It's a bit too long. It's a bit too slow, I guess, for a lot of people. But for me, I understand the longness and the slowness, but I really enjoyed it in this case. All right, so become my friends on goodreads.com. Check out the SFBRP listener group on goodreads.com and suggest books for me to read there as well. Yeah, I just want to talk a little bit about the audiobook. The audiobook, I really enjoyed this. It's a perfect performer. A narrator called Jefferson Mays really captures the spirit of the narration that's needed. Sort of like, what is needed here? What is needed is somebody who can do a perfect, upper-class English historical accent from around about the 18th century. And, yeah, it's just perfect. Sort of like, okay, my listener, I do believe, you know, I'm not even going to be able to do it. I couldn't do that if I tried. But, yeah, bringing out, like, sometimes there's French accents, sometimes Spanish accents, sometimes Indian accents, sometimes Japanese or Chinese accents, and sort of brings them all together in, a really nice way. Actually, I don't need to talk about the lack of some of the accents that could have been in this book, because that could be spoilers. It's something that I was picking up as I was going through this, which seems to be missing. Anyway, Jefferson Mays, really, really good audiobook, added a lot to my interest. And yes, this is the kind of book which I would maybe in like 5-10 years, I'll go, oh, let me check that book out again. And I would definitely read it as an ebook, not as an audiobook, probably on a second read through. So, or maybe I would have done it the other way around. I'd definitely listen to this book again, because I'm sure that once I get to the end of the entire story, going back and listening from the start, all of these different plot elements and ideas and world-building stuff, it'll all be a lot more meaningful. In fact, there's quite a lot of stuff that I remember from the start of this book by the time I got to the end, which is sort of like, yep, now remembering that what he was saying or what he was looking at or the character that turned up at that moment was a lot more meaningful than I would have thought. Right, so that's it from me. The next book that I'm going to be reading is The Stone Sky, which is the last book in the Broken Earth series by N.K. Jemisin, and it came out last month, this month, whenever. Also narrated by Robin Miles. I just started that this morning. It's probably going to be the next book that I review. So, yeah, email me, luke@juggler.net. I reply to every email that I get. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge there. On Instagram, I'm at Luke Burridge there. Follow along with what I get up to on YouTube. I'm Luke Burridge there. Check out my YouTube channel. And, yeah, I think that's just about everything. Oh, yeah, go over to sfbrp.com. And check out the website sometime. You can look at, you can find the archive feed from all of the episodes, from episode number 1 to 300. There's an archive feed for all of those episodes to get those quite easily. And, yeah, and check out the episode list. You can see a list of every single episode that I've done, all of the books, all of the ratings, the length and the authors and the series and all of those different kind of things, and links to the reviews of mine on Goodreads and the Wikipedia pages and all those different kind of things. Check it out at sfbrp.com. Right, that's it. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.